faith in destiny is all I need to prevail.
This is the Truth Frequency Radio Network.
Okay, guys, good evening. This is Beyond 2012, and I am your host, Tony Kudos. Tonight is going to be an education to all of you. I have a very unusual guest. His name is James Churchwood. He has undertaken what really can be referred to as a lifetime pursuit. He is an electrical engineer by profession. He's also an Eagle Scout. He's author of Lifting the Veil on the Lost Continent of Mu, Motherland of Men. He is the great-grandson of James Churchwood, and Jack is forging a whole new interpretation of lost continents and ancient civilizations. You can actually find his research online at my-mu.com. He's with us tonight to tell us about the book that he has already published and a brand new book that he has coming out in the very, very near future. It's going into finalization right now. He is going to give you a whole new researched interpretation of Lemuria. Henceforth, will be referred to as Mu. So it is with the greatest pleasure that we invite Jack onto the Beyond 2012 show. So welcome, Jack.
Good evening, Tony.
Tell us a little bit more about this immense piece of research undertaken by your great-great-grandfather. And indeed, you've taken over the reins of it, gone to publication with it. Tell us a lot more, because I know I really just skimmed the surface. So over to you, Jack.
Thank you. Starting in the 1860s, my great-grandfather wrote that he had, while he was on famine relief duty in India, he was interested in some engravings or some pictographs on the side of this temple that he was associated with. And the rishi of the temple noticed his interest and started to teach him what the symbols meant and things like that. And eventually James was able to coerce or talk to the rishi and get him to come up with some of the ancient tablets that he had stored in the vaults of the temple. They were called the Nicol tablets, after the learned brotherhood that had kept the secret and sacred ancient knowledge from the lost continent of Mu, which these tablets eventually told the story when they were translated and transcribed by James and the rishi. And James said there were only three people alive that could translate them. And unfortunately, he couldn't get the entire story, but he knew that he could get the general gist of the situation and what was coming up in the tablets that he had witnessed. And that began James' investigation into the lost continent of Mu and comparing stories from other civilizations and finding a common thread that all led back to Mu. Now, a lot of people call it Lemuria today, but I kind of think of Lemuria like Schlachter did, as the reason that lemurs got across the Indian Ocean. So he speculated that there was a continent in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Actually, Mu, according to my great-grandfather James, was in the Pacific Ocean. It sunk 10, 12,000 years ago, I believe. But it had a civilization that was, he estimated, 70,000 years old, and that's where mankind was originated, and they populated the Earth. This all culminated in the 1926 Lost Continent of Mu, Motherland of Men, which was the first book he wrote on the subject. And what I have done is take his first book, and I decided to look at it, since all my life people have been asking me questions about what I thought, and I hadn't always been given the opportunity to take a positive view on it. It was not something that my people in our house really looked at with any credulity at all. And so my basic focus has been to read it and research it and see where some of these ideas came from that he expounded on in The Lost Continent of Mu, Motherland of Men, and also The Children of Mu and The Sacred Symbols of Mu and two books of The Cosmic Forces of Mu.
Tell us a little bit more about the theories that really came from that book. And you obviously have some incredible insights through your great-grandfather. What exactly was the premise? What exactly was life like for the residents of Mu? And it's also intriguing. It's referred to as the motherland of men. So are you saying that our race, our species, originates from Mu?
That was James' belief, that it originated on this lost continent that was in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And like I said, James believed it sunk 10 to 12,000 years ago. And his underlying principle for the sinking of this continent and Atlantis and the rising of the sea levels and the mountains back then was that there were Archean gas belts underneath the Earth in the crust that eventually filled up with volcanic gases and whatnot. And eventually they blew and the land sunk. But James believed that they were an ancient civilization, obviously, but they were also advanced. He wrote about the Vimana in the 1920s, the flying craft that enabled them to transport themselves around in the air. And they were also great sailors and navigators. He wrote that they had a very high level of society, being able to build mammoth constructions, I guess everything about them. Some of the spiritual gifts of being able to read people's minds and things like that.
Yeah, many have speculated that they had a higher technology than we have today. Did you find any reference to that at all in your reading and research?
Well, what James writes about is that there was no religion back then. Religion and science were combined together, and that they were taught by the Nicol Brotherhood, N-A-C-A-A-L. They were taught by these learned priests and whatnot that they could learn how creation began, and it was involved in these Nicol tablets, the writing about science, so they could understand the principles that allowed the planet to be created, that allowed things to happen. And I guess the greater understanding that they had of the universe around them was what enabled them to profess a higher technology than perhaps, well, at least higher than what James believed they had back then.
So they amalgamated the spiritual aspect of themselves with their science. I mean, they had flying machines. They had the ability to move huge rocks. Was there any reference to how they did that? Because I know that's something that intrigues people, because it pertains to how many of the ancient sites were constructed in the first place. So were there insights into that?
Well, I believe there is. In the Cosmic Forces of Mu books that he did, there's two volumes of that. I have yet to get to them. I'm doing my research in a linear fashion. I've started with The Lost Continent of Mu, Motherland of Men. I've taken on his second book now. But I'm going in order, and hopefully by the end I'll be able to pull out the kernels of knowledge from his books.
So they had aircraft. They had the means to be able to move equipment themselves and travel around the planet. What references were there in the original writings to that?
Well, James, the translation of the Nicol tablets that he had, it essentially looked at the creation story, and it also provided some form of a discussion of the scientific principles. And James was very interested in that, and like I said, eventually wrote quite a bit about it in two volumes in the Cosmic Forces of Mu.
So what did they use for propulsion? I mean, were they using what we would consider, you know, propellers, jets, rocket power? Was there any reference to that at all?
Not that I've found. What I believe he looked at the inner power. For instance, he did not believe that the sun was a warm body, that the reason that we got heat from it was that there was an inner power in our Earth that interacted with some form of energy from the sun, and that's why we feel heat from it.
So they were tapping into this as an energy resource?
I believe so. Like I said, I'm holding off to make very much speculation about that until I actually discover something about it. And it's really not discussed in the volumes that I've so far researched.
I'm going to steer in a slightly different direction. The Nazca lines in Peru can only be viewed from altitude because of their size. Do you think that there may have been any link between those lines and the huge ground roarings with Lemuria at the time? Do you think that there is a connection there?
Well, there would have to be a connection, since James felt that everyone on Earth was from the motherland of Mu. So perhaps, I believe research has shown, though, that some of these Nazca lines are religious observances, allowing people to trace their way along these enormous pathways.
They do smack of an advanced technology, though. I mean, those lines are laser straight for many, many miles, not something that you could readily track out with one other person with a stick trying to align it up. I mean, these are laser straight. I just wondered whether there was anything that had become evident. So what do you think life was like in Lemuria then? How different would it be to how life is today?
Well, I believe it was much more peaceful. I'm absolutely sure of that. They didn't have sectarian violence. They didn't have... They all believed in the same core science/religion. The same. They all had the same beliefs. So they were able to understand what was going on around them, and they were obviously less scared, and there wasn't any reason to get angry with your neighbor about this or that. They could always communicate with them and avoid. So I believe they probably didn't starve very much, but life was probably pretty easy.
Maybe it's similar to what we have as our goal, where instead of everybody being separated, they were living a life where they were contributing to the community, and the well-being of all was more important than the well-being of one. What do you think?
Well, that was probably, once they understood what was going on and realizing that each of them was part of the Creator, then that would automatically follow that if they're helping their neighbor, then they're helping themselves and everyone around them.
Wouldn't it be a wonderful world if we could reestablish that? They had something obviously very special that we all of us really crave, and the kind of world that we'd like to live in, what many would call a utopia.
James wrote that savagery did not begin until the Lost Continent of Mu sunk, that it was the sudden lack of resources that was thrown upon them. You know, when the continent sunk, there were perhaps some colonies on other parts of the world that were suddenly cut off and didn't have the goods or the vehicles or whatever to keep their civilization going. So he believed that at that point, everything just fell into anarchy and savagery. But he said before that, that didn't happen.
So they were very dependent upon their technology, and much as it would be in this world, if something happened to knock out our technology, we'd be driven back into the Dark Ages. Presumably that's what happened to them, but there must have been some who escaped that event. Any reference to that?
Well, I believe when he spoke of the Nicol tablets and the rishis that could actually read them that are in Southeast Asia, in Southern Asia. And he also mentioned that there were some that escaped and were up in the mountains in Tibet, in the Himalayas. That's some of them might have escaped that and kept up their abilities and kept up the continued subsistence of their lifestyle. But unfortunately, they didn't want to reach out and help a whole bunch of other folks with it.
Is there a connection then between the Tibetans and those from Mu? Do you think that there was some kind of crossover there?
Well, actually, I have had the opportunity to speak with His Holiness Chötsong Rinpoche, the lineage head of the Drikun Kagyu lineage of Tibetan Buddhism. And I asked him about this very question, and he said he had asked all his monks and all the Rinpoches and the people in charge of all the monasteries to look. And the answer I received is that he has yet to find anything that pins back to the ancient continent of Mu.
There would appear to be some similarities. It seems incredible to me that such a marvelous and wonderful civilization should have just died out, I mean, almost overnight, without there being some residual that carries forward into humanity and some of that ancient knowledge and wisdom still being part of our history, part of our heritage. Have you seen any evidence of this being brought forward into humanity?
Absolutely. For instance, one example is the Wendover Bog, which is on the east coast of Florida. They were digging along one day to put in a new development, and the backhoe hit a skeleton. So they called in the archaeologists and started working on it, and they found 69 graves that were 7,000 years old. So 5,000 BC, absolutely ancient. The DNA shows that they're not related to any of the American Indians, or the what some people call the original inhabitants, but these people predate them. Amazingly, one of the burials was a 14 or 15-year-old who had spinal bifida, and they had actually, rather than, I believe most civilizations, when they run across something like this, would just cull that individual. They had nurtured him and cared for him for obviously 14 or 15 years, which is something different. That's not a savage society. That's somebody who, I mean, actually cares about the people around them.
Tell me something. Was there any evidence of there being any giants associated with Lemuria? Was there any reference in the texts? Unusual beings, unusually large and tall beings? Did you find anything like that?
I have yet to see any evidence of that in James' writings, and he doesn't write very much about. I haven't found any references to giants in his works.
I just wondered, because as I'm sure you're aware, allegedly they're digging up skeletons of giant beings, 18, 20 plus feet tall. So do you feel that they developed the technology in their own right, or do you feel that the technology was somehow given to them? Was there any reference to that?
He doesn't speak of any outside influences. However, I'll have to get back to the fact that there's the fusion of their religion and their science together. And it was the realization, and he does say that their information was imparted from what he terms as God. And obviously, God can be interpreted in many ways. Maybe if God was the outside influence, yes. But what form he took and what he was is up to conjecture.
So their means of communication, do you feel that it was electronic, or do you feel that it was somehow telepathic and that everybody was in open communication with everyone else? What are your thoughts on that?
I would not go for the electronic communications, but the telepathic, yes. I believe perhaps that was part of their existence. Once they realized the underlying principles of what was going on around them, perhaps they were able to tap into some energies that we have yet to discover, so they could move great objects, communicate with each other, and that type of thing.
So with that level of power, it's also surprising that they developed what you could call a hardware technology in the form of vehicles, aircraft. I mean, as I'm sure you know, with the Coral Castle, it's been alleged that the heavier items were moved by sound, but nobody really knows. So it would appear that maybe it was the civilizations of Mu who originally developed this ability. What do you think on that?
Quite possible. Someone who, you know, perhaps another little string of theory or string of knowledge and wisdom was passed down through the ages to allow today's people to use that. And perhaps yesterday's people, for instance, like the monuments at Baalbek and the Great Pyramid and some of the other mammoth structures around the world.
And we're back with music this time. And I have with me tonight Jack Churchwood, who has made a lifetime's work of studying Lemuria. And I've really got to ask the question that I know is on everybody's lips, and that is, where is Mu? Where is Lemuria?
Well, actually, James wrote that Mu, because James never used the term Lemuria. Mu was in the Pacific Ocean, and the remnants are Hawaii and Easter Island and some of the other South Pacific islands.
Okay, have you actually had a chance to get out there and see for yourself that area, maybe flown over it, or have you had a chance to look around and see what information there might be semi-hidden?
Not yet.
Okay. Yeah, you probably need scuba gear, I guess, pretty substantial scuba gear. How do you know that that is the precise location where Lemuria was?
Well, James used his deductive reasoning and what he learned from the Nicol tablets to make an estimate. He also used probably what the map is of the Pacific Ocean to see how it was. But essentially, Mu was there before the Archeon gas belts sunk, and what is remaining above water is what is what's left of the continent.
You would have thought that with this amount of ability to travel and to fly, that there would have been more evidence of the residence of Mu and this civilization, this culture. You would have expected it to have spread right across the planet. Have you seen any evidence of that?
Well, his thoughts of the advanced technology, it wasn't a hard technology like we have today, where we have actual devices and whatnot. His belief was that the people of Mu understood the physical forces around us and were able to interact with them so that They were able to develop their telepathic abilities to communicate and move things and that type of thing. They were able to control their Vimana with their brains, supposedly. I mean, they didn't have control panels. So that might have been that they walked up to a circular disc and had a thought, and this disc just brought them here or there or wherever they needed to go.
So the disc itself didn't physically move, or it did? Would they climb aboard it? Or would they have had, they'd have climbed aboard it? No, it was a disc. Now that's intriguing. Now, are we talking something similar to what most people refer to as a UFO, as a circular craft?
Well, I'm sure that with their advanced mental abilities that they were able to, you know, maybe they built one out of stone, carved up a big piece of stone, hopped on, and off they went, loaded up the supplies on the back, and off they went. But they also had sailing ships, which James talks about quite frequently. So it wasn't a, like I said, it wasn't a hard technology like we have today where you can find, you know, you can find a shovel or you can find an iPod or a telephone. If you were to dig up somebody in 100 years, you'd be able to find all those things from us. Unless that we're, you know, a nuclear disaster, but other than that.
Yeah, the prospect of a fossilized iPad is so because all of their technology then was, with the exception of the ships, which would have presumably rotted away, and there would be no evidence. There's no evidence of stone disks, so really there's no technology that would have carried forward and stood the test of time of 5,000 years
that they could point out. Correct. And it was, that's what James wrote about, and that's all I can go on. I'm not going to make anything up I'm not going to speculate until I'm not going to speculate until I read more of the cosmic forces of Mu, and I'm able to perhaps understand a little bit more of his understanding of what kind of technologies they had.
Yeah. So tell me, what inspired you? I mean, this was work from, as you say, 1927. What was it inspired you in your life to take up the challenge and the gauntlet of this and go ahead and read in detail? I mean, it must have been a very substantial manuscript that you were reading, and pursue it in your own right. What inspired you?
Well, for instance, when I read about the Wendover Bog, and I've read about several other instances that piqued my imagination, but that's coupled with the questions that I received on a daily basis. People asking me, what do I think of it? Can I translate some of these symbols for them? Or all kinds of questions. And rather than just blow it off any further, I decided to sit down and do research in a systematic style, and I'm an engineer. So I'm serially going through the information and learning what I can about where the information came from that he wrote about.
So, all right, so they had a high-level mental ability, probably way beyond what we would on the face of it be capable of these days. Was there any information, any instruction of how they developed this mental ability, this telepathic ability, and potentially the ability to move things around?
I think that was in I'm drawing a blank there. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I just wondered whether anything in the manuscript was giving just any guidance of how they did it, how they actually made this work, how they focused and developed that ability. But now you're working on another book. The first book, as you were telling me, was really taken from your great-great-grandfather's work. But you're developing a new book right now. So You're obviously taking that in a different direction. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, actually, it's his. The first book was written in 1926. His second book was written in 1927, and it's called Copies of Stone Tablets Found by William Niven in near Mexico City. And this book was originally done for his publisher. And this book was actually drawn, it was a hand-drawn 38 pages that William Niven sent him these drawings and, I believe, photographs of the tablets that he had been discovering since 1921 near Mexico City. And so James took these 22 tablets and looked at them closely and attempted and showed that perhaps they were very close to the Nikkal tablets that he'd seen in India. And what I've done is brought the reader to see what the tablets are, how they relate to his later works, and more or less place it into historical context of these tablets. I'm a little miffed that nobody knows where the tablets are, or a lot of his artifacts are missing now. They're no longer in museums, and no one has, even though there's pictures of them, and he did rubbings of them and described them in detail. There were 2,600 of them. They haven't been studied for 80 some years now.
Now, these were stone tablets, so these are the only things that have stood the test of time from Mu to current times. And as you say, there were 2,700 of them?
2,600, yes.
2,600. I mean, that they must have been substantial. They must have been heavy, and not exactly the sort of thing that you could tuck away in a closet somewhere. So your great-great-grandfather actually saw these tablets, is that right?
That's correct. Anybody can see them. If you pick up Niven's biography, Buried Cities, Forgotten Gods, there's pictures of a display case that he has, and that photograph is contained in the 1931 Lost Continent of Mu, and in The Children of Mu, he shows a picture of a cabinet with over 100 of the tablets.
Okay, so what do you see as the connection between Atlantis and Mu?
Well, my great-grandfather wrote that Atlantis was a colony, just like North America and South America and Asia. He believed that the Maya were the ones, the industrious ones, that set out across the earth and colonized the rest of the earth.
Okay, so you feel that there was a relationship between the two, that they were the same race, so to speak, or were they somehow separated? Was there a cultural separation in some way?
Well, perhaps a cultural separation after the individuals had been away from the motherland for some time. Perhaps there was a little bit of a separation there, yes, and it just grew apart. I mean, that's human nature almost.
Were they two different races? I mean, if you stood them side by side, do you think that there would have been something discernible, or was it just a pure cultural separation? Because, you know, Lemuria and Atlantis are always linked together as having suffered their demise simultaneously, yet they weren't, as far as we can tell, in the same physical location on the planet. And I think that's what's probably led to people surmising that there was some kind of event that may have involved some kind of nuclear exchange, maybe a war between them, something like that, unless you know differently.
Well, actually, James' theories are that there were Archean gas belts underneath the crust of the Earth, that, like I said earlier, and that they filled up with the volcanic gases and lava. And when they finally blew, they collapsed, and that caused the land masses in both oceans to sink and cause the water to rise elsewhere.
So this was a major planet-wide catastrophic event. There have been those that have speculated that the remains of these cultures are something in the order of 1,200 feet below sea level now. That's cataclysmic. That's just that's almost an extinction-level event.
That would be correct. Unfortunately, he writes that some people, I mean, if there was the motherland of man and the only people came from Mu, then somebody had to survive. So wiping out the motherland and some and one of the major colonies, which was Atlantis, still left some people in Asia and North America and South America. And he did write that there was a simultaneous cataclysm that wiped out what he called the Uyghur Empire in Asia. A north running ice storm that ran out and went out to Siberia, out the Arctic Ocean. He says that he was in, I'm not exactly sure the name of the island, but there's an island that is completely made of mastodon bones that he said he witnessed. Part of the cataclysm that wiped out Atlantis and Mu.
So perhaps then this was an event similar to that that wiped out the dinosaurs.
It could be quite possible, and it doesn't have the age or antiquity that the 60, however many million years ago that happened. But James imagined that this was from 10 to 12,000 years ago. And he places the Uyghur civilization as being colonized from 70,000 years ago. So obviously the colony of Mu, the lost continent of Mu was settled, and they had a civilization much older than that.
So I just need to grasp this, because you've given me a huge time frame of reference. For how long do you believe that the Mu civilization actually existed? Can you, without speculating, from your information, can you say how old that civilization really was?
I can't pinpoint it. All I know is that James wrote that the Uyghur civilization was 70,000 years old, and it came to its height at 17,000 years ago.
Wow. So therefore then, what you've just told me is that the Lemurian, the Mu civilization, is much older than most people have speculated it was. This happened a long time ago. And it has taken us all of this time to manage to attain a similar level of technology. But, I mean, that's a long time for a civilization to survive. What are your comments on that?
Well, I understand that it would be very difficult, but given the circumstances that prior to the destruction of their civilization, there was no savagery. So if everyone's getting along and everybody understands what's going on around them and they can control their physical universe, I can see that there'd be fewer problems cause their downfall prematurely, as opposed to a natural disaster taking them out.
Now, it's always been said that, you know, any civilization will peak and will subsequently fall under some kind of demise. In this case, obviously, the land masses sank. They died by drowning, whatever. But when you look at civilization these days, there is almost no similarity between the two. It sometimes makes me wonder, how did we lose so much? How much did we lose so much that was gained by mankind to bring us to the point where we are now? That nothing actually carried through to guide us? Because let's be honest, we're moving towards the demise of our civilization, but in a different way. I wonder how different the world would be if we had that information and the skills that those from Mu had. I mean, are you able to draw some sort of comparisons between the two?
Well, all I can say is that it first starts with realizing our shared human existence and realizing that we're all people here. We all have the same problems. We all face the same day-to-day. Well, some people face a lot more. But essentially, everybody is a human, and we just have to get along. Rather than taking it, you know, if you get upset about something, there's no reason to take it out on other people around you. If you're able to act in a friendly manner all the time and not let everything bother you, then perhaps it would be okay.
I think a lot of it comes from the way that everybody is separated these days, that we're made to focus upon the differences between you and your next door neighbor, the person you meet in the street. And there is a separation. I mean, you know as well as I do, you can walk down the road and say hi, good morning to someone, and they completely ignore you. And so the anger and the frustration largely comes from that separation. And they had something special. If they had this ability to have open communication and get along with each other, they had something that, as I said earlier, I'm sure all of us would crave. So, I mean, did anybody, as far as you could learn from through your great-great-grandfather and the tablets and the wisdom that he was given, I mean, how did they deal with the situation if somebody did step out of line? Was there any reference to that at all?
It's not mentioned that there was any revolutions or people. There was a book, Mu Revealed, by author Tony Earle, which is actually written by an author named Raymond Buckland. And he brought forth some of those theories that perhaps there was revolutions and things like that. But pretty much that book was a lark and really didn't have any bearing on what my great-grandfather's theories were. I have yet to see anywhere where anybody stepped out of line and was harshly castigated or punished.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's very, very different. So why do you think it is that your great-great-grandfather was privy to this information and was given all of this in-depth insight over anyone else? What made him special?
Well, he mentions in his books that he was there on famine relief in India and was at the temple and befriended the Rishi and developed a very close-knit relationship with him as far as the student-teacher relationship. And sometimes that can be a very close bond, and if you've obtained the right teacher, then there's a far way you can go.
So where do you think your research is going to take you next with regards to developing this, all of this in your own right? What do you plan on doing next?
Well, the next is, and I've already started on it, is The Children of Mu, a book that describes the mass migration around the world from James' theories on the mass migration around the world. I do have knowledge that there's another book out there called The Colonies of Mu. Unfortunately, it was never printed. It was never published, rather. But there is, it's about a 400-page book, I believe. And I've seen pictures from it and I've read about it mentioned in other books. So that's where I'm going to head. I'm going to look at The Children of Mu and how men colonized the earth.
A lot of people are going to be very interested in pursuing this and finding out, I mean, as you develop your research. Do you actually have your own website? And how can people get hold of your original book? I know that you're published through Ozark Mountain Publishing. But if they want to connect with you, maybe even possibly bring some information to you, we have a very broad listenership. How would they connect with you? How would they get hold of your book?
Well, to get a hold of me, I have a website at jack.churchward.com. My research website is my-mu.com. And if you want to read a little bit more about my book, it's at ltv1.my-mu.com.
Okay, that last
one. And I can be reached at jack@my.
I was just going to say that last one you gave was kind of complicated. Can you give that one out again?
Certainly. It's ltv1.my-mu.com.
Okay. And again, if they want to contact you directly, especially with information that they may have, and indeed, I guess, the whereabouts of a lot of these tablets. Someone out there must know where they are. So how, again, can they contact you?
They can contact me. My email address is on all those websites, but jack@my-mu.com.
Excellent. Do you manage to respond to all of your emails? I know you get inundated with a lot of emails after doing a show, but do you manage to get back to everybody?
I do my best. Yes, I do. If they're taking the time to ask a question, I definitely want to engage them and find out what information, because that's how this whole project has blossomed, actually. I'll start looking at a little bit of information, and I'll put a blog posting, and somebody will send me an email, and it'll fill in a little bit more of the puzzle. And that's the way it's been going.
Yeah, there's a lot of people out there do a lot of research in their own right. And, just from some tiny, tiny little idea that someone sends you can take you off in a whole new direction, especially if they can validate it. So that is excellent. Now, so is there any specific information that you are looking to try and unlock?
No, I'm just trying to use this information. I want to write a biography eventually of what I've discovered about his theories and tie them all together or figure out how they came about. And I really do eventually want to get to the cosmic forces of Mu and see if I can understand that so that perhaps that little bit of information and that ancient wisdom and knowledge can infect the rest of us, and we can push on toward a better, more hopeful future.
How do you see the lessons that are coming out of this? How it could help humanity in what, you know, really these are dangerous times for humanity. From what you've learned, what do you think you could bring forward to help us out in these times?
Well, it has to be that realize our shared human existence and where we are now, and calm down the negative energies and vibrations that are infecting and polluting our atmosphere, our public discourse and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, these really are difficult times. And we're back. This is Beyond 2012. I'm Tony Kudos, but you already knew that. And I have with me tonight Jack Churchward, who's carried out an extensive research, largely driven initially by his great-great-grandfather back in 1927. He didn't start his research. Jack did not start his research in 1927. But we're going to go on. I mean, there are other people who are conducting some extremely valid research into this civilization, its demise, what it had. So we're actually going to go on and discuss a book being, or research being developed by William Niven, and how that really pertains to Jack's new book coming out very soon. So I'm going to pass it straight back over to you, Jack. Well, not as the case may be. Are you there, Jack? You still got a connection?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, right.
I've been looking at copies of stone tablets found by William Niven near Mexico City. And it begins, it's the first time James actually probably looked and had the real good drawings and photographs of the tablets in front of him that enabled him to further his research and link them to the Nicol tablets that he had seen in India. Now, William Niven had a very active life. He was at first a mineralogist. He's best known for mineralogy, being a mineralogist, rather. He actually went to Mexico for the first time for Thomas Edison to look for, I believe it's gadolite, to find a mineral so that they could use it in light filaments. But he returned after he visited a governor of Guerrero there and saw his amazing collection of archaeological, the governor's archaeological discoveries. And on the way back to Mexico City, William Niven went through an enormous ruin. It was acres and acres, and he did little test pits and found wonderful things. And I imagine that's when he caught his archaeological bug. But Niven went throughout Mexico and did quite a bit of digging. And then later in life, he started, actually in 1911, he started digging in the Valley of Mexico. He surveyed an area of 2,000 square miles and then settled on a smaller area near some of the places' names are Remedios and Santiago Ahuizacla and some of the other names that are very difficult to pronounce. But they're, unfortunately, right now, they're all suburbs of Mexico City, so we can't go back there. But his discoveries, every Sunday he'd go out and with workers, he'd have a deal with the person who owned the land, the farmer or whatever, and they'd be digging. And he found amazing incense burners and statues and altarpieces. And in 1921, he started to find the tablets that are very well known in James Churchward's books. But first of all, before James came out with copies of stone tablets, James referred to his discoveries as the buried cities because he found, Niven had found, that there were three levels covered under the ground. And under the lowest was covered by a sheet of volcanic lava. And above that, he determined that there was a flood in the Mexico Valley that had covered them. And then above that, there was more with very few things from later civilizations. And he was able to find this enormous, over an enormous area of the Valley of Mexico, whole cities. And he discovered, for instance, one of his discoveries was a goldsmith shop that he writes about, that the work was so tiny and so small that, you know, it'd be very difficult for us to do that at home today. But he was able he discovered that, as well as printed murals on walls that he likened to as good as the Romans or the Greeks. So Niven had found quite an amazing array of artifacts, and no one was able to come up with any discussion of what they meant. They weren't able to interpret his tablets. But James Churchward, my great-grandfather, was able to. He, upon the publishing of his 1926 book, James devotes an entire chapter to William Niven, and it's called The Buried Cities of Mexico. And that's the point. When he takes on the copies of stone tablets, it shows that he's moving away from looking at the tablets and looking at William's discoveries as just the buried cities. Because then he's able to show now that he's actually seen some of them, that they tie in with the Nicol tablets and what his other writings were about.
Yeah, I've visited Mexico and the Yucatan, been to many, many ancient sites. There is so much information that has been lost, and it looks as if you've managed to find quite a lot of information about buried cities. How does that all tie together with Mu and, you know, or, I mean, literally, that the Maya, the Aztecs, etc.? How does that all come together? Are you seeing a common denominator at all?
Well, from James' writings, he mentions that obviously that everybody came from Mu to colonize the other parts of the earth. He witnesses that the cataclysm that wiped out the first colonists were then, when more came, they were subsequently wiped out by another cataclysm, the first being the volcano and the second being a flood. So to James, the Maya were the people who had the gumption to get up off their rock out there in the middle of the Pacific and set out and see what else was out on the earth.
Are you also seeing any commonalities in building structures and, you know, where there is a common influence that also may perhaps indicate that there was a common technology? What do you think?
I haven't seen any evidence. I understand that, you know, the pyramid is a very simple structure. It's very stable. You put your biggest stuff down at the bottom and you slowly go up in a gradual manner. And if someone decides that they're going to pretty up the lines and take out the steps in there, that's essentially what they did in Egypt in the Giza plateau. But I don't believe you don't see that in a lot of other places. Rather than having a pyramid that you went into, they have pyramids that perhaps you can go into, but you can also have an open-air temple on the top.
Yeah, that was very common with the Maya. There were many structures that I've seen that didn't seem to serve any obvious purpose, except for the fact if there was an advanced technology. I've witnessed down in Palenque, for example, what appears to be mounting points for technology, what appears to be some kind of portal through which they could travel around. Who knows whether it was just a limitation to the Yucatan or whether it was further afield. And so, yeah, I'm intrigued with this, that you are finding these tablets, because most people aren't even aware of the tablets you're referring to. So whereabouts are those tablets now? Are they still in the vicinity of Mexico City?
Well, when Niven left Mexico City, he had an agreement with the government at the time that he would give the best of each of the artifacts he found to the National Museum, and any seconds or duds that he put them on sale. And that was the arrangement so that he could continue to fund his excavations that he did every Sunday for 10 or 15 years that he did it. As far as being able to find them, I know several researchers that have gone to most of the institutes of higher learning in Texas, and they've attempted to ask about them, but they don't know anything. Now, Niven took rubbings of each of them, and he wrote down where he found it, the depth it was found, and any of the colors that were used on it. He also took photographs of some of the, some of the bigger ones, not color, but black and white photos of some of the bigger ones and the most outstanding ones.
You've seen a lot of these rubbings and a lot of this information. Have you taught yourself to actually read them, to actually interpret them?
I actually have not seen any of the originals. I've seen copies that were contained in my great-grandfather's books. There are some that are contained in his scrapbooks. I have yet to consider myself proficient to be able to undertake an interpretation of any of the tablets.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit like trying to learn to read Sanskrit or Sumerian. It's a language so, on the face of it, alien to our own. Is there anybody out there who has really become adept at interpreting these that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. Back in the 1860s, my great-grandfather said there were three people that could. Now, whether or not they passed along this information to someone, and if you're listening, please give me a call or send me an email or do it telepathically. But send me some kind of information, and then I'll keep your name quiet, and we can work on it.
Yeah, it seems as if you're reaching a point where some input from someone else with some knowledge. You know, really, it would be very, very welcomed for somebody else to work with you. Possibly in some joint enterprise. Because it's important that this information comes out. I mean, they had a very wide knowledge. They had an ability of making civilization work without it being driven by greed and, you know, a lust for power. Literally, in this day and age, that information would be priceless. So if there is someone out there who can interpret these and can read them specifically, I mean, presumably you have a lot of information that you really could use somebody to decipher. Is that right?
Well, essentially, I can rely on what my great-grandfather's interpretations of some of the tablets were. Another part of my work is, and I've started on putting together a compilation of all the tablets, at least the ones that are written in his books or are included in other works, so that perhaps there can be a start to a systematic study of the tablets.
This sounds
because
like
that hasn't happened yet.
This sounds like this could be the beginning of a third book.
But it's on a back burner. You got to do one. Got to work on one at a time.
Yeah, you were saying.
At least
me,
I do.
Well, you were saying that your second book is coming up for finalization and proofreading. Is that right?
Yes, I'm working on it, and I've got some local help that's giving me some excellent ideas and helping me make it. The best it can be.
So on the proceeds of this second book, is it your intention to take a little time out and actually go and visit some of these places and see what you pick up, not just from talking to people, but what you pick up energetically? Are you planning on doing some traveling in connection with this?
I'd like to be able to do that were the sales sufficient to be able to fund that, but that's in the future, so I'll have to answer that question if it becomes a bestseller or something.
Well, talking about books, one of the things that our listenership loves, having heard various guests actually come in on the show, is there a way that they can order a book directly from you and have you actually sign that book? Do you offer that?
I haven't done that yet, but no one's expressed any interest. And if they were, send me an email and I'll see what I can do.
Yeah, we had Guy Needler on the other week, and this is one of the things he said. He said, "Well, of course, you know, I can buy books through the publisher directly, and so if people would like to receive a signed copy, he said, all you got to do is ask, and it will be yours." Signed personally. So that's just something that you might be prepared to offer to people. And I know people like signed original copies, so that's one of your book. Is it in hardback or paperback right now?
It's in paperback right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's a big 8.5 by 11 kind of thing.
Oh, this is a real coffee table sized book then.
Yes, sir.
How many pages for your second book?
My second book, I'm up to about 160. Mm-hmm. And the first one is a little over 300.
Wow, that's a lot of undertaking. So from that point of view, obviously you're going to be moving very soon towards that third book, and that's really where the input is going to be of primary importance. So outline again really the kind of people you want to connect with. And if there's anyone out there that you're having difficulty connecting, we have a lot of people who have a lot of connections, and maybe we can help you get through to the people that you want. So, you know, if the world was your oyster and your every wish would be granted, who would you really like to make contact with, or what type of people?
Well, I would hope that everybody could look at the book and discover what resonated with them, so that they could come to some of the understandings that my great-grandfather came to, the understanding that we're all here on the planet and that we're able to go back to that if we try, if we all work together toward that. And that's what I would be I don't have a particular audience or crowd that I'm interested. It's just a look at his work and trying to understand it, and I'm just making it available if anyone else wants to follow me along that path, or maybe help open up other pathways, because I reference other works in his books. In my book, I reference other theories that are close or similar, or where it's possible that his information came from.
Yeah, I was actually watching something on YouTube, I think it was, the other day, and they were talking about how we put out an electromagnetic field far around us, largely emanating from the heart region, and that everything is interconnected. Literally, they had a petri dish with some natural yogurt in it, with two connections in it, and it was responding to the mood of the person who was speaking. He was talking about making contact with his attorney, and immediately the yogurt freaked out. But one of the things that they were underpinning from that is that everything is connected, especially anything that is alive, especially. And it seems that this is something that the Lemurians, you know, the people from Mu, were very much tapped into, the total interconnectivity of all living things, and how literally one person's mood can affect everything around them. And so you have I know you have insight into this. Obviously, what I'm trying to do is hone down as far as I can, without you going into the realms of speculation, of how they actually did this, how they had I'm trying to picture a whole civilization where everybody is interconnected. Everybody can communicate telepathically. I mean, it would be overwhelming if you were constantly tuned into all these people. So how, I wonder, did they differentiate, or could they turn this ability on and off, do you think, as and when they pleased? What do you think?
My thought is that perhaps they did have these abilities, but there wasn't as much negativity. There wasn't as much things that you had to filter out. There wasn't, you know, the clingingness of some people that, or the negativity of anger, and those things weren't necessary. So as they progressed through their day, they could just allow their normal interconnectedness to just continue, but like I said, there's not the negativity and anger and whatnot.
Yeah, I'm a great believer in collective consciousness, And the ability to do some amazing things. I've witnessed some myself where a group of people were totally connected and achieved something. But this is on a much, much grander scale. And imagine a world where everybody was at peace and would openly communicate with each other without any of the aspects of the modern world where people are separated. I think this is the goal of humanity, is to get back to this point where we can all communicate and we are aware of everything around us. I mean, Mu was obviously a very peaceful place to live, but was it just limited to Mu, or do you think it was far more widespread than that?
Well, being that they colonized the rest of the Earth, imagine that they were able to spread their consciousness and their abilities to around the world, taking up different, obviously at times they'd backslide, or they'd go off in a little bit different direction. But then again, that's the reason for the Nicol Brotherhood and the teachings, to be able to calm everybody down and get everybody reset back to the proper knowledge.
Now, you refer to this as proper knowledge, as something very different to what we have today. That, you know, that there was a collective knowledge then, a collective wisdom, a collective understanding, yeah?
I believe that's the case, that what James spoke about was that everyone was taught how the universe functioned early on. And that was their basic teachings. There was more about how things were created and how the different powers worked in the universe, how they were created, how everything around them was created, and obviously how they operated the various utensils that they used, whether it was a vimana or an enormous machine to move that big block from here to there and build a new temple.
Yeah, so the temples that they built, I got a question for you. If they had a collective consciousness and a collective awareness and the ability to communicate with each other, what was the purpose of the temples?
Well, what James writes about the temples is that they were roofless, so they could allow the rays of the sun, the RA, of the sun to come down and touch them it allowed the energies from the sun to positively affect them.
I understand.
And it also allowed them the opportunity to congregate in a central location.
So it became a focal point. So I'm wondering what a concentration of consciousness in one place, what the purpose of that would be. I'm just kind of reaching out there, but if they were all in constant communication, why would you need a focal point? What do you think? Don't worry, we're coming hard up on the break, so we'll see if we can explore that a little bit more, because I'm intrigued. I want to know more about collective consciousness. We will be right back after the break. Beyond 2012 with Tony Kudos, and just in case you just joined us, I have Jack Churchward with me, and we're discussing all of his research and that of his great-great-grandfather into what most of us know as Lemuria, that is the civilization of Mu, and we're in the last segment now, so we're going to really explore whatever we can dig into to find out what really they knew, as much as we can, about how they had this ability to communicate with each other, and really how maybe we can learn from this and start to develop our own civilization. So obviously you've been in contact with a lot of other people who are looking into this research. Are other people being aware of this collective consciousness, Jack?
Well, a lot of people don't I don't believe, understand the collective consciousness, the fact that we can. I'm not saying that nobody does, but I'm just saying that as far as James Churchward's works, they look at, I think they stop at the point where it's an ancient civilization, and I don't think they carry it over to try to work on it themselves to bring about the change. I mean, they point to it and say it's an ancient civilization, but I don't think they understand how they were able to do it.
It just seems a great shame that they had this way of merging the spiritual aspects of being human as well as the technology that they had. They merged it. It blended. And we can't do that now. I mean, science is deemed as reigning supreme, is the only way of looking at it. And if that information or that event cannot be reenacted in any laboratory anywhere on the planet, then it's not deemed as being given credibility. But these Atlanteans, Lemurians, the Mu civilization, they were tapped into this, and this was as natural to them as breathing air. So how...
Well, I've seen evidence of it today.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Obviously, everybody's read about the Tibetan Buddhist monks that are able to take wet cloths, wrap it around themselves, and sit down and meditate, and in a period of time, they're able to steam the water all off of them and make them absolutely dry. I've seen some other things that I don't really wish to elaborate about that actually make me believe that these are an untapped resource that we have, but we haven't attuned our minds to be able to do it.
Yeah, I mean, people are so separated from this in general. Remote viewing is an established science. The Russians, the Chinese have been doing it. We have been doing it. In fact, I believe the Chinese are considered to be the very best in the world. And there's all these aspects of being able to be given a location and for these people to be able to go and visit that location and look around and come back with specific detail. And the military have been using this ability for a very, very long time. I mean, it's a proven fact that they can do it. There was even a guy on the radio last night who has won the lottery several times. He's developed the ability to be able to see what the winning lottery numbers are going to be. And he's proven it over and over and over and over. In fact, he doesn't work anymore. He's actually retired on the proceeds of his lottery winnings. So there are so many aspects to humanity that, even though it's proven, people still scoff at. They go, no, 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 it couldn't possibly be. It couldn't possibly be. Well, it's a proven fact. It's not some kind of theory that just maybe might be able to do it. It's actually proven that people have developed the skills to be able to do this and to be able to go and see what foreign military are doing. And as a result, you know, you've tapped into something here where there was a civilization where this was part of their everyday life. It was readily embraced and acknowledged, but somehow we're told, no, 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 that couldn't possibly be. It couldn't possibly be that they had a technology greater than ours. Well, we lost thousands and thousands of years of development in technology that we could have had all that time back, and it was lost to us. And it really does beggar the question, why was it lost to us, even despite a cataclysm? There must have been those that survived it and carried that forward. But for some reason, we are not privy to it. Why do you think we're not privy to this information? Because there are obviously people out there who do know this.
Well, on some levels, there's obviously people who are benign and they're more helpful. They like to see the advancement of society, and they nurture those around them. And you have people that are exactly the opposite. who like to control everyone around them. And my thought would be that, unfortunately, maybe the people that did maintain these abilities were more of the latter category. And that in the beginning of your training, in the beginning of your life, you need to take the opportunity to calm down and relax. But if they're able to, if the people who wish to control you are able to keep you going, and so that you're not able to calm down and relax, that might be an explanation.
Yeah, I know of a little boy back, well, not such a little boy anymore, but was a little boy, went traveling in France with his parents. He would have been about 5 or 6 years old at the time. And he suddenly became very, very agitated. And his parents didn't know what was going on. And he said that he could see men in the fields fighting and killing each other. And on further investigation, it turned out that where they were, there was a major battle. And this kid was actually seeing it. And when they got back to England, the first thing they did was take him to a child psychologist, because he couldn't possibly be seeing this. There was no way. I mean, there's another incident of a child in England who was a fighter pilot in World War II and came back into this lifetime with a huge amount of information about flying aircraft, flying, you know, flying fighters, that he could not possibly have learned from television or anything else. And yet people turn away from it and they go, no, 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 this couldn't possibly be. No, no, no. He's seen it on TV. No. There is so much that we are capable of and we could tune back into, but we're turned away from it because we're told, no, 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 that couldn't possibly be. Well, my argument's this. You know, can you all sit down in front of a piano and play a concert? No, you can't. But there are those who can. But does that mean that because you can't do it, it doesn't exist, and that there are no concert pianists out there because you can't do it? And we're being turned away from this, and it's all part of the isolation that stops us from becoming a collective. And that is part of the purpose. And you are bringing forward the information that there was at least one culture that we're aware of who had this ability to totally work together in a totally cohesive way. So I think you're bringing something very important to light. And I think it's something we all need to be aware of, that there are these innate abilities that all of us could tap into if only we would step outside of the box. What do you think?
I absolutely agree with you. As a Tibetan Buddhist, not a very good Tibetan Buddhist, but I'm a Tibetan Buddhist, and one of the beliefs is in reincarnation and the fact that what you did in your last lifetime is what you're going to be doing now, and what you're going to be, and what you're doing now, what and what you change will be what you're going to be doing in your next lifetime. So I understand completely about reincarnation. I mean, there is a soul that, there's a consciousness that continues, and you create the causes and conditions for what follows. Karma, right?
Yeah, I can relate to that. I'll just tell you, I'm not coming back. This world's too insane for me. I'm not coming back here again. They couldn't offer me anything that would make me want to come back here again. I'm going to try somewhere else next time around. But if you could change this world, especially from the point of view of the Buddhist aspect of who you are, what would you do?
Sir, did you cut out there?
We're having a few technical issues today. I mean, you have a background in Tibetan Buddhism. If you could change this world in which we live right now, or you could move towards that change, what do you think you would do?
This might sound a little bit crazy, but I think everybody should learn to use firearms and carry one, and we'd be a whole lot more polite to each other.
Yeah, I think one of the...
I know that sounds rather silly, but the fact is that it would allow us, at least for a while, to develop respect. I'm not saying we should go around and shoot people. I'm just saying we should allow everyone the opportunity to become respectful of each other, as opposed to always not recognizing each other properly.
The danger with that, though, is that not a respect born out of fear?
Well, eventually the fear will vanish as you get to know people.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people who, let's say, live on the other side of what most of us consider to be law, but they have, to my mind, a misinterpretation of what respect means. I don't think that respect means if you don't treat me right, I'm going to beat you to a pulp or I'm going to blow holes in you. Respect is something, to me, very, very different. That I respect this other person as a fellow human being walking their own pathway through this life. That I have empathy with that person and an understanding of who and what they are. And in many cases, it might be that, hey, I'm grateful I don't have to live their life, that they're learning that life lesson themselves, meaning that I don't have to do that. But I think the understanding of the word respect has been totally lost. What would you say your interpretation of the word respect really is? Because there's a lot of people out there really don't know.
Well, I'm not sure that my definition would be very much different than yours. I understand that we do have to realize or recognize and respect the fact that we share this planet. We share our common problems. Each of us have to eat. Each of us have little things that are burdensome every day. And if we just start to respect the fact that each of us has each of these little barriers to a perfect life, perhaps it'll be a little nicer.
Yeah. I just find that a lot of people, I mean, I'm not just talking about young people, I'm talking about mature adults, have somehow lost what the meaning of that word respect is. That, you know, I respect your right to be here. I respect your right to breathe the air, to have your space, to have a home, to have food on the plate, to have clean air to breathe and clean water to drink. That really, that other person's life isn't wildly different to mine. It doesn't matter what color or creed or race or religion they are. That the common man really wants the same thing. They want to be able to live a peaceful life, to be able to have the at least the basics of life, be able to bring up a family and live out their days without being threatened, injured, involved in a war, to be called upon to have to go out and kill people in the name of some cause that may or may not be virtuous, and in most cases isn't, that I respect. I have no respect for people who go out and kill each other, no matter what the premise is and whether they're told to do it or not. To my mind, taking a human life is the ultimate sacrilege. It really is. Even if it means that you're having to take another human life to defend your own or the life of another. Sometimes it has to be done. I accept that. But when life is taken in the name of the corporations and a cause that may not be just, that is wrong in my world. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right to a point. There are, as you said, some instances where it's necessary that you have to stand up to the bad guy, the bully, or whoever is in your face threatening you and the family that you've taken the responsibility to protect. Obviously, if someone threatens your children, I'm going to do everything I can, or my children, if anybody does anything to them, I will do my best to ensure I don't hurt you too bad, but I'm not going to let you hurt my children. That's just not in the equation. And perhaps I misspoke when I said everybody should carry a gun. I really think that if there was one thing that I could do, it would be to help people to understand that the divisiveness that goes on in our government and then flows down to everybody around us and into even the non-governmental sectors of our world. It's kind of ridiculous that everybody fights about everything and they can't, there's no more tolerance. There's no more getting together and finding a common solution that will work. They're so hard to get what I have said has to be it, and they're just not willing to change. And I think that's one of the things that perhaps I would like to see changed.
Yeah, American movies always amuse me that, you know, when there's some huge meteor coming in, or there's the San Andreas fault line's about to give way and all the rest of it, that we nuke it. That's how we solve problems. We wheel out the nuclear weapons and we go hit it, irrespective of how many people will be irradiated by the fallout and everything else. You know, it's the ultimate solution to everything. Let's go nuke everything. And that's exactly...
They're not scientists.
No, they're not.
So they don't understand all the consequences of their actions.
Well, there are never consequences. I mean, war, for example, is something that happens thousands and thousands of miles away. It's a whole different ballgame if that nuke affects you. To my mind, nuclear weapons are the ultimate bent arrow. You fire it, it flies around and hits you squarely between the shoulder blades. But that is the kind of world that we have, the ultimate solution. Rather than work it out, find another solution, we nuke it. I mean, how crazy is that?
I'll agree that it is the use of nuclear weapons, nuclear power might be fine, but I agree about nuclear weapons. Unless it's space aliens that are invading us, and that's the only way we can get them out of here.
You've just got me going on a point. All right, I'm going to throw this one out there. There's been some speculation recently that we have used energy beams or that we have brought down motherships, that sort of thing. I got to ask this question. If there is a huge mothership has come in from outer space and is here, is it really a good idea for us to shoot it down and expect no retaliation? Again, this is how we handle it. We destroy it. If it doesn't fit into our frame of reference, we destroy it. It's the same with another race. It's the same whether it's space aliens. I mean, I could just imagine, yeah, bring down a mothership. Yeah, the next thing you know, there are going to be 20 of them. And they are coming in with guns at the ready. And I don't think we could handle it. But yeah.
Well, there's obviously been a lot of movies discussing those circumstances. But then again, the spirit of human beings to survive is, I don't think that can be discounted. Perhaps we can bring down one. Maybe we'll get a huge project salvaging some of their weapons out of their mothership and take them on when they come back.
Yeah, I can just envisage it. Yeah, you know, that we're there with one particle beam or something. They come in already knowing what they're going to be taking on. And I suspect that if they can traverse the vastness of space, that they probably have something with a lot more potential than a nuclear missile.
I'm sure of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a brave man who would take on an advanced technology like that. But yeah, you know, we send up jet fighters to try and chase them, and of course they never catch them because they're many, many times faster than our aircraft are. Oh, but hang on, I forget. Sorry, it's swamp gas. it's all these other things, but it's never actually a craft from off planet. But I wonder about everything that we've talked about tonight, that there was maybe some outside force that was directing the folks from the Mu civilization, and from the Egyptians' point of view, there was more, far more technology than we have now. It may be a very different technology, but far more than we have. Because they could do things that we still can't do, even with our so-called modern technology. So one day, maybe we'll be able to build something that will last from our civilization for many thousands of years. But at the moment, if something were to happen to us, within 1,000 years, there would be no points of reference to our civilization. And I wonder, really, in our current times and the way that humanity is, should we really even bother to send a message forward in time of who and what we were and what we considered the values to be? What do you think?
Well, I think we should. But I'm not sure that we should explain what the circumstances are of our time, and maybe we'll provide them the opportunity in the future to avoid some of the mistakes that might call our, that might cause our downfall.
I think we should, for future generations, tell people how not to do it, because I think that this could become the demise of our particular civilizations. Maybe we should do it, send it forward. This is how not to do it, folks. No matter which way you go, do not do it this way, because it will have the same end result. We're coming really close to the end of the show, Jack. Would you give people again means how they can get hold of your book, how they can connect with you, and give it to it slowly, give it to the listeners slowly and precisely, so they can notate it and write it down?
All righty. You can go to, for my book, Lifting the Veil on the Lost Continent of Mu, Motherland of Men, you can access the webpage at ltv1.my-mu.com. And it's available from Ozark Mountain Publishing, and Barnes & Noble and Amazon also has it. My research is located at my-mu.com, and I have a podcast and blog. My personal website is jack.churchward.com.
Excellent. And your book is readily available. When's your new book come out? When do you suspect that that's gonna hit the streets?
Well, I hope it's later this year. But I'm working on it, and it hasn't actually gone for approval yet, but I'm sure that it'll be picked up.
Well, that's great. And Jack, really, we're pretty much at the end of the show. I want to thank you for coming on, and as is always the nature of broadcasting, you came on at relatively short notice. Really want to thank you for that. Hopefully we can steer some people towards bringing you some other information that I know that you would welcome. Any final thoughts before we go, Jane?
Certainly. If anyone does have any information, I've got questions all through my website asking about all kinds of things. And if you can answer any questions, especially if you think you can interpret or decipher some of James' writings, please send that information along to me.
Well, that's great. Well, I wish you well with that. I wish you incredible success with your second book, and know on the strength of that you're going to be moving on to at least a third book. We're coming up on the back end of the show. Thanks again, Jack.